away from family, away from your friends, away from church, away from all that you've known, how would your faith live? How would your faith survive? How would your faith reveal itself? Now, of course, I know the reality. We do have some that have just gone off to college. But I mean, not just only for those that are off to college just recently and come back every weekend or so, but where would we be if we were to be without those that are close to us that keeps us accountable? Would your faith be genuine? Would your faith still be vibrant? Would your faith still be real? And that God would still be in your midst and that you would live with God still? Or would it be nothing more than fickle? You won't go to church wherever you're at. You don't fellowship with God. You don't commune with God. I want to challenge you guys, however young you guys are, I believe that all of us here, especially those of you guys that are young, I want you to know that it is really in my heart to really see you guys grow. It is actually one of my biggest pain and biggest heart is to see that all of you guys that are young to really live out a genuine faith that walks with God. That is a faith that is more than just emotionalism, more than just hanging out with your buddies, but it's a faith where you walk with God even through the difficult times also as well. I know that all of us, those that are younger, can live out a faith that is much more greater and more genuine and living out to service to God also as well. So take these words as words of encouragement and for challenge. And for those of you guys that are parents here, I would encourage today's lesson is really to talk to your kids also as well, to challenge them to say, hey, let this be not a faith that is only for those of you, that's only a mom and dad's faith, that you're only there, mommy and daddy's faith, sorry. When I talk to my little girls, I always call myself Dada, right? But you know, a faith that is genuine, that is not just only because you're telling them, but challenge them to say, hey, live this out for real. Today I want to look at this passage in 2 Kings chapter 5. Really, we're going to focus in verses 1 to 7. And my purpose today is really to challenge all of us to be more faith in Christ in three ways. To be more our faith in Christ will grow. Even when life is hard, that we're still walking with God, that we ought to be, secondly, to walk with God, no matter how young you are, to forgive and to love even those that give you a hard time, your enemies. That's one way, second way that we see God's faith is genuinely living in us. And also, thirdly, our true characteristics of faith is also demonstrated that we trust God's word of what God is able to do, to trust God's word of what we're able to do. These three aspects is, I think, demonstrated really with this girl that we see in Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, setting this context, what we just read of 2 Kings 5, by way of context, 2 Kings focus a lot about kings of Israel and Judah, yes. After all, the book's name is Kings, right? That's a hint, right? A lot of kings were not really that good, not really faithful, didn't walk with God. You see some, there's also prophets of God that come, that rebuke the kings, rebuke Israel, and say, hey, turn back to God. It is in this context that we read that in the midst of Israel's sin, God will often judge Israel and God's people in Judah and everything else by bringing neighboring countries to come and attack them. In this specific instance, in 2 Kings 5, we read in verse 2 that the specific people that were attacking Israel because of Israel's lack of faith and not walking with God as a means that God is chastising them, disciplining God's people to return back to Him. The specific nations that were invading and attacking were known as the Arameans. Yes, you see that in verse 2, right? It says the Arameans had gone out in bands and started attacking. Now, who are the Arameans? The Arameans are today, actually, if you go to the Middle East, there are some people that still call themselves Arameans. Now, today, most of them are culturally Christian. They live in an area called Syria, right? So, Syria attacking Israel, I mean, you think, wow, is there history ever repeats itself, right? I mean, even thousands of years, there's this history that still goes on, right? So, these, basically, in essence, people from Syria were attacking Israel in verses 2, with bands that would raise Israel and would take belongings back. Really, it's for lucrative and monetary or some kind of financial gain that there is. Now, according to verses 1, one of these leaders of the Arameans that attacked Israel was a man named Naaman. And Naaman was mentioned as a captain of the army of the king of Aram, who was a great man with his master. As great as he was, you see the end of verse 1, there's a predicament. It almost seems like he had it all. He is a warrior. He is one who is respected. He's a leader. He is one that even the kings spoke highly of. But despite all these things in terms of worldly greatness, one thing, as it says in verse 1, that he had going bad for him was the fact that he had leprosy. Yes, right? Leprosy being a disease, skin condition where you can't really feel, where you're also weakening of your muscles also as well. Now, who do you think in this time period of living, all this troubling time, I think it's fascinating because in 2 Kings, there's all these names that are mentioned. So many names we don't remember, right? So many names of great kings, of great prophets, of all these people. But in the midst of all this passage here, with this guy named Naaman, with all his condition, with all his problem, we were going to see the story and saying, how could he be healed? And in the midst of all these characters, I think there's one we could easily miss, and that's really, if I could play a game here, or just a little bit of pun, if you will. Naaman is this guy that's a focus. But I think there's someone else that I think is really the main figure of the story, is a girl with no name. So it's not so much that focus here is really on Naaman, but it's really on this girl with no name that I really want to look at. And as we look at this girl with no name, I think in the end, we will see that the hero of the story is not Naaman, it's not Elisha, it's not kings or anything else, but it's really through this girl as a pointing towards God, the hero of the story is really God. But as we look at this, I think we see that there are some examples that this young girl, this young Jewish girl with no name, no hierarchy, nothing emphasized here, that she is in some sense showing us in three ways that our faith, even as young or how old, whatever you are at in your spiritual life, we can emulate the faith she has. We can emulate, no matter how young you guys are, we can emulate her faith in three ways. With the first being today, be like this girl who still follows God even when life is hard. Okay? Even when life is hard. Her life here in the story is not easy. First and foremost, it is not easy being little. Yes? Being little, I remember even. I'll be honest with you, I can't wait to be a pastor 10 years in the ministry. I can't wait to have gray hair, just to be able to counsel more people, right? There's something about youth that's great. One good thing about youth is oftentimes youth does not know danger sometimes, right? Youth are more prone to taking risks and doing great things at their young age because they don't think about all the costs of everything. They're just going to go out there and change the world. But the drawback oftentimes is being young is people don't take you seriously and everything else, right? You see here, her life is not easy. She's young. And according to the passage in verse 2, she's little. She was a little girl who's also taken captive, yes? She was kidnapped. According to verse 2, she has been taken captive from the land of Israel. And not only after she was just kidnapped, taken away from her mother and father, from her home, from everything that she's known, she's taken to another foreign land, yes? And when she's taken to a foreign land, you see in verses 2, she ended up being what? A slave, yes, right? She is now a slave. Specifically in verse 2 said that she waited on Naaman's wife. The term waited upon is usually the idea of a servant, right? It's usually those that are lower wait upon those that are greater, right? So here she is. She's waiting upon Naaman's wife, right? She's waiting upon the very wife, the very family of the leader, of those that led the armies to attack and the band of, you know, basically thugs and murderers that attacked her people and brought her kidnapped. Now she's serving. And not only serving these people, but serving the leader of that, right? Specifically Naaman's family, was specifically Naaman's wife. She was really not important in the story. She had no name, right? No name mentioned. I mean, think about this. You look at this passage before in 2 Kings 4. We see even the Shunammite woman, though she's not named, she's identified more specifically here, right? We see all these names in chapter 5 also as well. Elisha. We see the name of even Naaman. We see all these names of all these people that are important. And in the midst of all these whirlwinds, she's not important. Her life is difficult. She's forgotten. She's not someone important here, right? Life is difficult in this aspect. She's just merely called a girl in verses 2 to 4. It's not like her name is, you know, shows the lack of a mention. Her name shows she's in a situation that's difficult. She's basically forgotten, right? And this is also as well, we see, also as well, this is, she's, in the difficulties revealed that she's forgotten, not important, and also as well in contrast to her foil, which is Naaman, right? Look at the contrast. She's this girl that's forgotten, and she walks with God still, and yet this other person, that's the enemy, is an emphasis of importance, right? Naaman's actually described here as a captain of an army, contrast to this girl that had nothing, that's a mere slave. Naaman's called a great man, whereas she's just called a little girl, right? Naaman is highly respected, and she's not mentioned in any of that, right? Naaman's actually mentioned as victorious, as it says, because by him the Lord has given him victory. He's described as a valiant warrior. He even had slaves for his wife, according to verse 2, the Arameans had gone out in band, and taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited upon Naaman's wife. Other details reveal he's important is the fact that he could even get the king to write a letter of recommendation in verse 5 to go into Israel to try to seek a prophet that would heal him. He's important in contrast to this girl who is going through this difficult time in the period in the fact that Naaman as a foil had a lot of money, as you see in verses 5. When he departed towards Israel, what did he bring with him? It says 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes, right? You remember, in this context, even in their day and age, clothes for most people at that time period was the most valuable thing people had with them, right? Clothes was the most valuable thing. It wasn't like they had, like, you know, oh, I have a CD somewhere, investment somewhere. Clothes sometimes for some people at that time was the most precious and expensive things they had. And he had 10 of it. Not to mention he had all these gold and coins also as well, shekels full of them, right? Thousands of days of labor, you know, years worth of people's, you know, most average person's working wages a year here, right? And here he had, also had horses and chariots. In that, those biblical times, people that had horses and chariots were really close to the king. Because why? Back then, horses were also considered weapons of war. That if the king decided to attack them, they would come to you and say, hey, remember how I allowed you to have a horse? Well, now I expect you to be this knight and come over and fight for me also as well. As I mentioned in verse 9, he even had chariots also as well. This is in contrast to this girl. I mean, in light of this, if we put these two together, we would say, yeah, this girl is going through a difficult time. She had none of these things. She is in a trial with all the things we've mentioned earlier, right? Yet, the things of God, ironically, of all the difficulties, she could just say, hey, wow, look, God's enemies, God bless. Why would I live for God anyways? Why should I think about God when God inflicted upon me all these trials and tribulation? When even we even see with our own eyes that God's enemies in the incarnation of evil that she could see with Naaman himself is blessed. It seems outwardly, humanly speaking, blessed by God, right? Blessed by God. She could easily walk away from the faith and say, yeah, I have nothing to do with my mom and dad. Is not going to be here to teach me faith. But notice when we pick up verse 3, God and the things of God were still in her mind. Verse 3 says this. She said to her mistress upon hearing about Naaman having a disease, having leprosy. Notice what she says. I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy. Did you guys catch this? In the midst of all her suffering, I want to call attention to the fact that she still saw her place and where God puts her. As humbling as it is, she saw that was a place that God has had, right? There's no animosity with her words against her master. She calls him, Naaman, her own master. She didn't just, remember, her direct master is really Naaman's wife. But she still addresses Naaman, not just say, hey, that Naaman guy or that captain of the guards or whatever else. She calls him master and says, and wishes well blessing upon him also as well, saying, hey, if only he knew and would go to the prophet of God who is in Samaria, right? I mean, that should blow us away. She's thinking, as all these sufferings, she still has God in the back of her mind, so that even when she's away in the Gentile territory where she's not able to fellowship with God every Sabbath, every Saturday for the Jews at the time, she still remember God and still remember the things of God by her mention and in her memory of even the prophet of God in Samaria. Specifically here in this context is Elisha, which is a story in 2 Kings 4 and 5 here, right? She still remembers God. Both you and her could trust in God because God is in control. We must not forget this. This is what's driving her, is the sovereignty of God. Because if you look above in verses 1, why did Naaman was able to have his victories? Was it because he was really strong? Was he a good-looking warrior? Was he like did he look like a Marine Corps poster boy image? You know, did you see there that he's going to win and conquer armies and everything else? No, according to verses 1, it says, because by him, the Lord has given victory to Aram. Who gave this guy victory? Is it he conquered all these armies by himself? No, according to verse 1, you see the sovereignty of God here, right? It is the Lord who caused the victory for Naaman. We must not forget the sovereignty of God here. Actually, I think the theme of the sovereignty of God runs big in 2 Kings verse 5, chapter 5 here, right? She does not forget God's sovereignty here, right? Sometimes we don't understand exactly what's going on, but even with tough time, God was going to use this girl to witness here, in this story here, to a Gentile, right? I mean, think about this. God has called us to reach all people in the New Testament era, yes? Right? Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 to 20. Go therefore, go out to the nations, right? For the Jews, if you read that, the word nation there is ethnos, which we get our word ethnicity. But for Jews, they called the nations goyim. And oftentimes they use that goyim as a bad word, like, oh, you're just Gentile, right? You're just a pig-eating Gentile, right? Like, you're just dirty, right? We don't really see in the Old Testament much outreach towards the Gentiles, right? Is that true? It's mainly the Jews kept to themselves, but we know even from Abrahamic covenant, God has always wanted Israel to eventually reach out to the nation, but Israel is struggling with their sin so much, they could only be inwardly focused here, right? And even in the Old Testament, when God's people and God's prophet reach out to the Gentiles, they always had the good attitude behind that. No, right? We think of Jonah. Probably the most successful preacher in the Old Testament. I mean, the whole city of Nineveh that's hardened with God. I mean, he threw a big revival meeting, bigger than Billy Graham's thing, and thousands of people came forth, and he's not happy because Gentiles being saved. But now you see, in this story here, God's, just an indication, just a little window of God's heart. God wants the Jews, and God's plan, God didn't just bless the Jews just to be blessed, to be rich, and have banks and everything else, but eventually is to bless the world here, right? And then you see just a little window in the Old Testament here. God was unfolding his plan, a hint of things to come, with this little girl here, an insignificant girl in the world's eyes, the fact that God's going to use this individual to reach out to a Gentile. So in terms of application, for those, especially for those of you guys that are young, if you guys could look at me in the eyes just real quick. For those of you guys that are young, so if anyone here is under 65, if you're not getting senior discount on Denny's, you all are young here. Every one of you guys here, right? For all of us that are young here, right? Know and be challenged with the prophet of God, with this girl here. She is a slave in this humble circumstance. As young as she is, does she live for God? Yes, right? She lived for God. She might have been taught the great truths of God, but she applied it, right? All of you guys, listen, some of you guys, if I could share this real quick, not that we make the preachers every hero of our stories and everything else. Some of you guys, I look back when I was a young Christian. You know why I ended up coming to this church when I was, 18? Was because when I was involved, I got saved at 15, just zealous for the Lord and everything else. Some of you guys here know so much. I look back, wow, you guys knew more than me when I was 16. The reason why I ended up going to church was because as we were involved in the Christian club, I remember thinking, wow, there's always this one kid named Victor who wore his pink pants back then and volleyball. And we'll be doing all these things and everything else. One of the things that stood out for me is always he knew so much about it. I'll have all these crazy ideas and Victor would say, I don't know if this is the most biblical thing. And I'll be like, huh. Wow, this is a pretty honest, good critic. Why? And he'll always say, hey, there's a biblical reason of this or that. And I'll be like, wow, like, how does he know all these things? Like, wherever he's coming from, there must be more where he's coming from. Eventually knew the source was TCAC, right? Listen, some of you guys knew so much. It not ought to be that you guys are going to school just merely getting by, right? You ought to be witnessing to your friends, right? You ought to be sharing the word of God. You ought to be, if I could even say, leaders of also the Christian club. With all that you know, you're able to do things, right? You ought to be ready to go into the Christian club and just share the knowledge and take leadership. Not pridefully, but say, you know, I know this is a biblical thing. You know what? You're fiery, passionate, and everything else, but this is biblical truth, right? And live it out, right? And not just only say, you know what? We're just here another day, going to church, hearing another guy preaching up there, you know, just throwing his voice and everything else on 4047 North Durfee Avenue on a Sunday morning at 11, right? All the truths you have, live it out and apply to go out there to be a leader and apply the word of God, right? To reach out to those who does not know him. And here's this girl. She has not forgotten the Lord, even though she's removed. How much more are we able to have the precious joy of reminding every week of the truth of God also as well, that we go out knowing these truths and apply it, specifically applying it and sharing these truths to those who do not know him, right? Make sure you do the right thing. Not only when your pastor or your parents tell you, right? But you do things because you really walk with God, right? Commune with God. Read his word. Even the things you know, even when you, I didn't read the word of God this morning, or I don't feel like it. Remind yourself of the truth of God in your mind also as well. So you live it out also as well. And as a challenging question, do you only follow God when it's easy? Because in this situation, this lady, this little girl, did she follow God only when it's easy? No, right? She walked with God even when other human beings are not there to keep her accountable in terms of another Christian or Jewish believer. Second application, second point I want to go over is be like this girl who loves even her enemies. It's not easy to love people. I know that because I'm a pastor, right? It's not easy to love people, especially with difficult people. But I also believe that you want to know how much you love God. You want to know how much you genuinely love? Because it's easy to come when Victor plays the guitar, you know, he's playing, you know, rock star, whatever. You know, it's easy to love God when we are in a retreat and say, I love you, Jesus. And then later on we eat a beautiful, you know, beautiful lunch at Master's College. It's easy to love God then, right? But I think the genuine test of whether or not we love God is whether or not, how is it that we love others, in particular, difficult people. In particular, difficult people. Here we see that this girl's love for God, this girl's faith in God is radically demonstrated in the fact that she's able to even love her enemies, right? I really believe, listen, if we really know how great God's love is, that will move us to say we will love all people, even with difficult people, even with enemies also as well. In this story, the character whom the reader should pity on is who? Is really this Jewish girl, right? If we read this story and say, oh, you know, if someone there's to be pitied, I think it's this little girl, right? I mean, this little girl, I feel like going to Peter Lou and say, hey, this shoebox, could I send this to Syria, to this little girl, right? This is how much pity we would have with this girl. But as we read this story, this one thing we should be blown away is there's no mention of her being pitying herself, right? I know that might be an argument from silence, but I think it was done intentionally. We don't read anywhere she's pitying herself. Moreover, this little girl does have pity. But the pity is not directed towards herself. It's directed towards who? It's directed towards Naaman, right? I mean, her master. I mean, this should blow our mind away. This little girl has no pity on herself that we could see. I know it might be silence, but I want to go even further. Legitimate exegetical observation in the fact that her pity was all directed towards who? Towards her master. I would say in the story, the one that we all have pity more for is this little girl. And we could say to Naaman, your leprosy, you brought upon yourself. You attack God's people. You think God's going to bless you? Ha ha, you got what you deserve. At least in my flesh, we could say this. Or when we are in our flesh, we could say this. But this little girl loved her enemy so much that she could pity her own master who's subjugating her, who's doing her wrong to her, right? Note in verses 3. She said to her mistress, I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, then he would cure him of his leprosy. She didn't just take pity upon him, but her words led her to real, genuine action of love. She didn't say, oh, I feel bad for you. Okay, that's it, and walk away. But notice it goes on, she actually gives an actual solution to the master's wife, right? Even though she had every reason not to. Remember, she's Jewish. Do Jews usually get along with Gentiles, historically speaking, and even the Bible record that we see? Not really. But yet she crossed that boundary. Don't forget that Naaman is the leader of the army that kidnapped her, right? She's a slave and he's a master. How could she not count these things against Naaman? I think the only thing that could explain this is she grew up very fast. Actually, she probably matured well beyond her age and well beyond the age of even some of the adults we see in the Old Testament. And maybe even more mature than some of us here. When we struggle with forgiving and forgiving others, or how we treat those that are others or different than us, right? We see that she grows because she loved, it's why she said all these things, is in some sense she's grown to love her master, right? She's grown to love her master, and she can love her master because, I would say, because of her relationship with God. Because her love of God is so deep, it has moved her to say, you know what, all these things people do bad with me, I'm not going to count them. Those things are so small and insignificant in God's eyes, right? So real test of whether or not you love somebody, I think, is what do you do when someone's not watching? Will you still do the same act of love and kindness even when no one else sees it, right? I know Nancy told me a little story, one of the stories that the mom liked to tell when Nancy was growing up, when she was little, is about her and her relationship with her older brother, Tim. Tim, you know, when they were like really little, like 2 and 1 years old, Tim would be all hugging Nancy. He will be all hugging Nancy when the mom's around. But as soon as the mom turned a corner, he'll grab a fire truck and just start hitting the head of Nancy, you know. Of course, they love each other. They've grown more than that. But just think about this as an illustration, right? How you show your love is, what do you do when no one else is watching? When no human being is there to say, oh, wow, that's so cool. You show kindness to your enemies, right? To those that do harm, right? Will you still show the same level of compassion, same sacrificial love also as well when others are not treating you well? As application, I know, I actually think kids are very cruel. Who agrees here? I think kids could be very cruel. The things kids do to one another, it's crazy. I just remember when I was like 14 years old, I went to Marine Military Academy. Just like, I go back to regular high school afterward, and people are looking at me like, Jimmy, did you just steal a line from Lord of the Flies? I still haven't read Lord of the Flies. I don't have to. And they're like, that sounds so much like it. Is it really? Oh, no, I've never read Lord of the Flies. I'm not a sophomore yet, right? Be like, wow, that's just crazy. Just how the viciousness of each other. I would even say, after being an adult, you know, going 18 years old to the Marine Corps, I'm glad our country does not use like preteen boys in the Marine Corps. Because I think if the Marine Corps actually used preteen boys, there will be no villages in Iraq that survive. Right? There's something more even vicious about boys than even like guys that are 18 and 19 years later, right? So in light of this, as vicious as you are, as some of you guys boys face all these things and just roughness of everything else, and even girls. Wow, girls could be premeditated, right? And what they say to another, you're like, wow, that really took some time, like 30 minutes at home thinking about just the hurtful words to say, right? In light of all these things growing up, as those that are young, will you be able to forgive people when people want to treat you as an outcast? Will you be able to say, you know what, I forgive them, I'll move on, I'll just laugh it up and just, hey, just brush it aside because it does not matter. Because my God's love is greater. My security is in God's love, not in what people say and their attack upon me, right? So I'll challenge you guys, be encouraged with that. The more you're hurt by others as you're growing up, and some of you guys will face more, and if you guys actually speak out for God, hey, sometimes people look at you as this weird Jesus freak or whatever else, but it's okay, right? It's okay. Because you know what? Find your security, find your identity in Jesus Christ. That will compel you to keep going. And you know what? It's okay, right? No matter what they say. And even one great thing, as you minister, as you live it out, you'll be surprised years later. As much as the people sometimes that attack you, make fun of you for being a weird Jesus freak, some of those guys, years later, when they add you on Facebook finally or whatever else, they will reveal that, hey, they remember. When it came time they want to seek the Lord, they will remember, hey, that person stood for Jesus. I made fun of him, but man, I will go pursue him because that person was serious in his walk with God, right? So live that way. Live that way and find your identity as you guys will face more peer pressure. Some of you guys that are young, going into junior high or high school, whatever else. Live with that. And that's driven by your faith in God, that your ability to forgive others. And not only just forgive others, say, oh, I let you go, but to actively love them also as well. To actively show love and compassion, okay? Third point we want to look at today is also be like this girl who trusts that God can do all things. Trust in God who can do all things. Remember the incredible words of faith this girl demonstrated when she spoke to her master's wife. Verse 3, when she said to her mistress, I wish that my master were with the prophets who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy, right? These are incredible words of faith. Number one, the incredible word of faith is demonstrated by the fact that she just says it out as if it's a truth statement. That, hey, my master, if she's with the prophet of God, God would definitely heal her, right? Incredible words of faith, yes, right? I mean, think about it. She could have all the reasons to say God is like dead in my life. God's not saving me. All my circumstances are bad. But despite all the things she could see visibly in her eyes, that outwardly human flesh says, hey, everything is going wrong and not according to our plan, and is God really behind this? She still has faith that God's able to do incredible wonders, right? Incredible wonders. This little girl trusts in God's power, even though all her situation says, hey, you could easily say, hey, God is not there, right? This is also her faith, I think, is in an incredible contrast to the context of everybody else in 2 Kings. Let me say this again. Her faith, this little girl's faith, is incredible contrast to the faith of everybody else in 2 Kings 4 and in 2 Kings 5, the chapter before this and after this. Now think about this. Look at this faith of this girl, right? In contrast to people that were much more greater than her. People that are greater than her include the king of Israel. If you look again at verses 6 and 7, let's look at the faith of the king of Israel. Verse 5, actually let's back up in verse 5. Naaman realized, hey, you know, I know there's someone that could heal me in Israel. Maybe there's hope, I don't know, but I'm going to go testify now. He, in order to go to Israel as not invading anymore, in a more nice diplomatic ways, he realized, hey, I need to get the approval of the king of the Arameans, the Syrians. So according to verse 5, he gets a letter of recommendation, and he goes over with Israel of all these money, right? By the way, I know some commentators, if you read more liberal ones, they say this probably is not true, because how could an enemy of God, Israel, enemy of Israel in Syria, go over there, right? How very unlikely. I would say that's when people say that, they don't even know history today, right? In Israel, do enemies Israel go to Israel for medical treatment? all the time, right? Matter of fact, if you're following this summer, Israel, remember that back and forth that they had after these three boys were kidnapped and then they were killed grotesquely with Hamas. Did you know all that was all going on? That Abbas, which is the president of the Palestinian Authority in the other side surrounding Israel, you know where his wife was? While he was condemning Israel for all these things, you know where his wife was who needed medical treatment? Was in Jerusalem. Under the care of a Jewish doctor, right? Hamas, right? The terrorist organization. One of the leaders had his daughter was having this surgery in a regular Gazan Palestinian hospital, and somehow it ended up being a routine thing, but ended up having all these complications. Guess where they flew her into? To Israel to be treated, right? So I think in light of that, if it could happen today, it could happen back then too, also as well. Especially when this guy feels desperate, right? He's desperate for all kinds of treatment. He would go over to Israel. So he goes over to Israel with this letter in verse 6. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "And now as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel got this letter in verse 7, how did he respond? He said, "All right, maybe a great opportunity for diplomatic, closer ties and everything else, so we just show kindness and everything else." He doesn't do any of that, right? Matter of fact, he starts get theological real quick, but not in a way that pleases God. Verse 7, "When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, 'Am I God to kill and to make alive that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of leprosy? But consider now and see how he's seeking a quarrel against me.'" His eyes is only political here, right? He's thinking, "I am not God. How can we heal this person?" And you know what? When you look at the statement, there are statements that are false and there are statements that are true. Statement that's false is that he saw this as, "Oh, this is a political ploy to set me up. It, look at them. They're trying to set it up where we become an enemy and it's just another justification to attack me." Is this really what was going on? We know, of course, it's wrong because of everything before verse 7, right? That Naaman is genuinely going out there to seek healing of some sort because of this little girl saying this, right? But one thing he does say correct is the beginning part. When he says, am I God to kill and to make alive? You're right. The king of Israel is not God. That's why whenever we read the Bible, we have to be very careful of making sure that we live in American culture. We love making celebrities, right? Even Christians, right? We love to make the next... What's his name? Basketball player. Chinese guy. Jeremy Lin, a great hero, right? We love to make... what's that football guy? Tim Tebow, right? We love to make him a hero and, you know, put our fist or whatever else in our cheek when we pray. We love to make hero. I mean, our evangelical culture is love to make hero, right? We just need to find someone that's really bad and boom, we make him an instant hero, right? 3 months later, he's baptized. 6 months later, a New York Times best-selling book about his testimony. 9 months later, who knows if he's walking with God, right? Whatever else we see here, we love this thing. But notice here, he's right when he says, "Hey, I'm not God," right? Because the hero of the story is not any man here, right? This is contrast. I mean, this king had faith? No, right? He had no faith. Naaman himself, did he even have faith? As we read on, when Prophet Elisha says, "Hey, go and wash in the valley, the river of Jordan," how did he receive that? It wasn't one with joy. He started making fun and say, "Wash in the river of Jordan?" I mean, the river of Jordan is these small little rivers. And remember, the more smaller it is, the more easier it's dirty. Because, right, the stronger it is, the more it washes everything away, right, and everything else. And they're thinking, what? Like, you're talking about, I mean, you got to look up pictures of the river of Jordan. It's, you know, going through all these ragged rocks and everything. It's like all these, like, dirty stuff, right? It's not like a cool water source of supply. And he's mocking the prophet of God, saying, "What? There's cleaner river where I live from Syria," right? Now, going back even 2 Kings chapter 4. I remember the Shuhamite woman. Now, we don't have time to develop this, but this is a woman that ended up Elisha staying with. And did she treat Elisha all well? Not necessarily, right? Not necessarily because she had really no faith in God, right? So in all of this, you see that all in the midst of all these things, this small thing, this is why it's very important when we read the Bible, we have to read it God-centered. This story here, we could easily miss this. This story emphasis is really on this little girl, and everybody else is a foil. She had great faith, even though everybody else is losing faith. Even though everybody that's important and significant and the movers and the shakers of their day and age is losing faith in God, God brought out this little girl mentioned. We don't even know her name. One day we'll meet her in heaven and say, "Oh, you're the little girl, right?" So this little girl that in the world's eyes is not significant, and yet she has great faith in God. great faith in God. I would challenge you with this as application. We hear today a lot of messages preached that, hey, you know what? God can do great things with you. You're special and everything else. If I could say, none of us here is really that special. If anyone is special, it is God and Jesus Christ, right? This point of the story is to say to teachers, I think, is, will you be willing to be someone that in history will not have any names but live out your faith for God, right? Will you be willing to be this girl that, yes, God will use you, but it means that your life will not be one that's necessarily in the world's eyes a blessing, a good thing, and everything else? And I could even add an application for those of us that are parents. Would you even say that, hey, I want the best for my children, including the fact that, hey, I will live this faith out and want my children's best, even if it means that the world would say, no, this is your children's not successful. I was even talking with Mark, several times during the week, right? Will you be willing to look at your little kid and say, hey, I want the best for you before God's eyes, even if it means that they're not a doctor, a lawyer, a dentist, right? Will you be willing to say, hey, that's okay? Will you be willing to say, hey, if my kid wants to be a missionary, right, with no 401k3, whatever it is you guys were talking about last week, right, would you be okay and saying, yes, this is God's will, and I'm okay with it? Will you be okay with even looking at your child's eye and say, if my child is going to grow up serving Jesus, mean that they're going to be a martyr for Jesus? Will you be okay with it? I know it's not easy. I know it's not easy because I have three little girls. When I look at them and see Rebecca and Abigail, I say, wow. Hopefully, we've taken this ACI and ace well and go to Harvard or something, right, or whatever else, right? But will you be willing to say, hey, I want the best for my children, even if in the world's eyes, everything is going wrong, right? Taken away from home, taken with all these, the curse, we could almost say, of being someone's slave and everything else. But will you be willing to say, going in God's path is best, even if the world says, hey, your child is unsuccessful, right? In ending the message today, I want to say that I want to mention also as well that one of the challenging part I think for most of us is really the issue of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not easy, right? Forgiveness is not easy, especially I would say even our culture. And our culture is right in this regard. Whenever we see things that are hurt towards children, some of the injuries that we could receive as an adult, it's bad. But it gets even more worse when it's little ones, yes, right? Rape is bad, but when it's rape of little children, we feel like, oh, wow, like, you know, I feel I'm ready to get arms, you know, to vigilante justice, right? Because we know that whatever injury, whatever sin towards a little kid, it often traumatizes them for the rest of their lives, right? And yet in this little girl, we see the story of someone who's able to forgive. I want to end with this message about really forgiveness. I think it's really the way you know, I'm more and more convinced, the more I live, the general way you know you really are living for God, that you say you have a radical love for God, is really how much are you able to love those that hurt you, right? It's challenging for me, because it's challenging for all of us, because sometimes we can look at a situation and say, yes, it's definitely right that the person has wronged us, right? I was reading a news story last night. I was reading a news story that really moved me. It was really a story about the Vietnam War. It moved me because some of you guys know, my mom, was from Laos because of the Vietnam War, because of all the war. My mom's village was actually bombed by the Americans, and they eventually fled. And eventually, my mom came as a refugee, sneaked over to Thailand. And even just some of the things that my mom tells me, I'm thinking, man, that's like, I did not see war. I did not see war compared to what my mom shared. And it was a story, really, of this girl. And I think it's one of the worst pictures of Vietnam War. Some of you guys have seen it. It's a little picture of a little girl running out naked because she was been bombed by napalm. You guys ever seen that picture? Yeah, if you guys know anything about napalm, it's probably one of the worst kind of weapon, right? It's actually a petroleum-based fuel. I'm just going this just for context. It basically sticks to you and burns. It's really hard to remove because the purpose is really to burn your enemies, right? It's so bad that even the last Iraq War, 2003, the United States used that limited. The first Gulf War, they used it big time. And if you ever look at, if you really want to look grotesque, you could Google just the travesty of people frozen in place, just the torment look, right? And this picture of this girl, running away to me, I always thought that's the saddest picture of Vietnam, because no matter what view you take, whether it's right or wrong, there's innocent people that has gotten hurt. As I was reading the news last night, I found out that this girl actually survived. She's actually, an adult. And her story is actually an amazing story, because after the story, she's basically it was 1972, changed a lot of the views of the Vietnam War. It was already changed before, but that picture, I mean, the guy that took the picture went on to win all these prizes with the picture, because it's a picture of great travesty. And apparently in her life, she went on to live. After the picture was taken, the photographer took her away and actually didn't just take a picture and that's it, I'm an outside observer, took her to a hospital, was treated. She ended up surviving, ended up living in communist regime Vietnam, and she was heavily watched by authorities because of how international significant she was. Eventually, she petitioned and went to study medicine in Cuba. But she did not want to stay in Vietnam. It was in the flight in Cuba, going to medical school in Cuba, while she was in Canada, she decided, you know, I don't ever want to go back to Vietnam. So she ran away instead to seek immunity in Canada. She ended up being a Canadian citizen. But in the midst of all these turmoil, she ended up visiting America, who she saw as an enemy. And I believe it was in a hotel room. She started reading the Bible for the first time and discovered the message of Jesus Christ. The message of Jesus Christ forgiveness of all these sins, and it moved her so much that she trusted in God. And years later, she's able to forgive even all those that were bombing. I know she says she forgave America, but technically in 1972, the bombing was actually the South Vietnamese pilots that were bombing her. Was able to forgive that, and God ended up using her, not just only to forgive, but to give this message as a basis to share the gospel. The basis to share the gospel, and now she's even leading a foundation that even does great work in Africa with orphanage and everything else. And as I put that on Facebook, I discovered, hey, you know, this is a small little world, right? The church that Benji has gone to the Philippines, that we sponsored to go to the Philippines to Vietnam with, apparently one of the girls that goes there, or actually I shouldn't say girl, she's a lady now, who who suffered through the Vietnam War, who ended up being basically adopted by Americans because of various circumstance out in Michigan, found out that, wow, they actually work with this lady. What a small world, right? If I could say one thing, as we hear these stories, as we see the story of Naaman, as we hear even the story of this lady, of this very famous picture, who would ever thought, looking at the pictures, I look many times thinking, did she survive? Whatever happened to her, right? God's story doesn't just end in a picture. If I could even say, putting this in the context of today's news, as we hear all these miserable news in Syria and in Iraq of ISIS and everything else, I'm reminded of the story of Naaman, the Syrian who goes and attacks God's people. Is this happening right now? Yes, right? In Iraq and Israel, where cultural Christians are being killed, right? We're not know the details, but I can't wait. This is one of those reasons I can't wait to go to heaven to hear what was God doing in the darkest chapter of the history of humanity. What is God doing also as well in the dark corners of your life, in the dark chapters also as well? I believe God is working in you, not because you are somehow awesome, though some of you guys are, but it's really because God is more awesome. In the darkest chapter of history, in the darkest chapter of our own lives also as well, will you believe and trust in God, right? Don't just only believe that, oh, your circumstance will get better, because it's easy to have that when there's nothing else to look, but to ultimately put our faith in God Himself, to say, I will follow Him. And the way you know is genuine faith in your tough situation is demonstrated in whether or not you still think of things of God in your tough, dark hours of your life. Will you still love your enemies? And will you trust that God is able to use these circumstances to glorify Himself? Let's close in a word of prayer.